inexpensive to produce, highly entertaining, no other, not offensive or useful in any other way whatsoever. It is chewing gum for the brain. It is fantastic. I love it. It's good for us.
Not good for us. It's probably the most detrimental programming in the world. It's turning the public into a bunch of jackasses that don't know anything about anything. A good show on current events is what we need. People are so stupid. It's because of these shows. They're just stupefied by it. It is worse than the worst kind of drug.
I get that a lot. Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Jay Won't Dart's podcast, 1970s horror movies. The movies I'll be mentioning are Deranged, Deliverance, and Soylent Green. This episode I'll give tiny reviews for some of my favourite DVD movies. All these movies are of the horror genre, and from the 1970s, and as we all know, old things are scary. But first, I'll start by telling you about my friend's new podcast that's on the way. It's going to be totally excellent. Lots of informative talk and interesting opinion. Well, basically, so the deal is that...
I can introduce myself. Okay, so let me start off. My name is Desmond, and I will be setting up a podcast very soon on, well, whatever I feel like talking about. Me, I might try and capture the essence of Desmond and, I don't know, some other subjects that interest me and could be interesting to you. You never know. I should have my podcast up by this Saturday, which I believe is the 9th of May. So, I'll leave you with Jordan, and he will be able to tell you how to find my podcast. If he doesn't know, just type in my full name, which is Desmond Rickerink, R-I-K-K-E-R-I-N-K, and you should find it pretty easily. So, that will be coming up very soon, so until then, I will see you. Thanks everyone, and thank you, Jordan. Back to you.
But back to me. Yep, thanks for that, Dez. Yeah, I'll get back to my episode now. Yeah. I have the trailer for each movie and some sound clips from famous scenes. I should give you a warning now. There'll be heaps of spoilers. I always read about movies before I see them, normally the Wikipedia page, to see if it's worth seeing or not. But I know some crazy people who actually enjoy being surprised by movies. Weirdos. Rather than knowing the ending before you hit play on the DVD, or sit down at the movie theatre. The point of my little movie review is to tell you about movies I think you should see, so I'm trying to convince you that it's worth buying or renting the DVD. I can't show you fancy fire explosions and slow motion like movie trailers do, so I focus on the plot. Hollywood should try that sometime. However, if you don't want to have Deranged, Deliverance, or Soylent Green spoiled before you've seen it, then it's time to stop listening to this episode right now. You've been warned. First movie is Deranged. I saw part of Deranged years ago on Sky Pay TV. It was the part near the end with the young woman in the snow, very messed up. Here's the trailer for Deranged.
This is where the worst begins. This is where we must stop. For beyond is the work of madness.
Death!
The nightmare of insane murder and lingering death. Deranged. For Mary, it was only the beginning. For Christine, it was already too late. For Dolly, the worst was yet to come. And only Mrs. Cobb knew what he would do next.
I really love you, Mary.
Sometimes you don't want to believe what you see, but sometimes it's true. The story of a trail of butchery so brutal that newspapers refuse to print its horrifying details. When the horror becomes unbearable, it is too late to scream.
As always, I hope you search for the video clips that I play, audio only. You really have to watch these for yourself sometime. I've tried to put the links in the show notes that show in the lyrics mode of your iPod. I say that every episode, huh? Deranged is based on Ed Gein, one of the most well-known killers in history. Here's what Wikipedia has to say. Alex, the Mac voice is going to mess up his name. It's pronounced Gein.
Ed Gein. His mother moved to location to prevent outsiders from influencing her sons. Edward Gein left the premises only to go to school. Besides school, he spent most of his time doing chores on the farm. Augusta Gein, a fervent Lutheran, drummed into her boys the innate immorality of the world, the evil of drink, and the belief that all women, herself excluded, were prostitutes and instruments of the devil. She reserved time every afternoon to read to them from the Bible, usually selecting graphic verses from the Old Testament dealing with death, murder, and divine retribution. With a slight growth over one eye and an effeminate demeanor, the younger Gein became a target for bullies. Classmates and teachers recalled off-putting mannerisms, such as seemingly random laughter, as if he were laughing at his own personal jokes. To make matters worse, his mother scolded him whenever he tried to make friends. Despite his poor social development, he did fairly well in school, particularly in reading. Gein tried to make his mother happy, but she was rarely pleased with her boys. She often abused them, believing that they were destined to become failures like their father. During their teens and throughout their early adulthood, the boys remained detached from people outside of their farmstead, and so had only each other for company. After his brother's death, Gein lived alone with his mother. Augusta Gein died on December 29, 1945, from a series of strokes, at which time Gein lost his only friend and one true love of, and he was absolutely alone in the world. Gein remained on the farm, supporting himself with earnings from odd jobs. He boarded up rooms mostly used by his mother, such as the upstairs, downstairs parlor, and living room, leaving them untouched. He lived in a small room next to the kitchen. Gein became interested in reading death cult magazines and adventure stories, and between 1947 and 1954 made as many as 40 nighttime visits to three local graveyards in order to exhume a number of recently buried bodies. Human skulls mounted upon the corner posts of his bed. Human skull caps used as soup bowls. An array of shriveled heads. Skin fashioned into a lampshade and used to upholster chair seats. Skin from the face of Mary Hogan, a local tavern owner, found in a paper bag. Socks made from human flesh. A sheath made from human skin. A human heart. It is disputed where the heart was found. Deputy reports claimed that the heart was in a saucepan on the stove, while crime scene photographers claimed it was in a paper bag on the floor in front of the stove. At least four noses. Gein denied having sex with the bodies he exhumed, explaining, they smelled too bad.
Scary guy, huh? And now the Wikipedia plot for Deranged.
Deranged is a Canadian-American horror movie made in 1974 and directed by Alan Ormsby and Jeff Gillen. It is also known by the title Deranged, Confessions of a Necrophile in the USA. It is a low-budget movie that has since become something of a cult film. It is widely considered to be the first accurate portrayal of serial killer Ed Gein's life on film. Plot. Apparently influenced by the true case of Wisconsin serial killer Ed Gein, the movie stars Robert Blossom as Ezra Cobb, a seriously disturbed man in his 50s who is dominated by his bedridden mother. After his mother dies, Cobb loses all grip of sanity. Lonely Cobb begins digging up bodies of women from a local cemetery to keep his mother company. Ultimately, he progresses to even more horrific crimes. Although the tone of the film is dark and disturbing, like the subject matter, there are occasional glimpses of black comedy. Star Robert Blossom does an excellent performance, creating a character that is not only frightening, but strangely sympathetic as well. At various points, a narrator, played by Leslie Carlson, walks into a scene and delivers an update on what is going on and suggesting to the viewers what horrors will lie ahead. all delivered in an appropriately creepy tone of voice. The film possesses a truly chilling atmosphere and the gritty look of a grindhouse picture.
Apparently, the dead bodies in the movie are made from chicken wire, plastic skulls, and painted cotton. The faces are plaster casts from crew members. Also, Mrs. Cobb, the elderly mother who dies, the actor who played her was only 14 years older than the actor who played Ezra, her son. I hate the word actress. It sounds demeaning to me, like an actress is a woman trying to be an actor. I don't get why actor can't be for both genders. Here's a clip from Mrs. Cobb, what she thought about women. Throughout the movie, we see clips from what Ezra remembers her telling him.
Just got to get the circulation going again, that's all.
So it's to be now then, is it? I can't see you too clearly, yes? You look blurred.
You're tired, Mama, is all. Here, I brought you some soup.
No.
Good and hot.
No, I'm not tired and I don't want no soup. I'm dying.
No, Mama.
I'm dying and that's all there is to it.
No, you just need some rest is all.
Oh, you be quiet and listen to me. If I go into a coma, don't take me to no hospital. I want to die in my own bed, my own room, with you here. If you need any help later, after I'm gone, call Maureen Selby. Say it now as Maureen Selby.
Oh, Maureen Selby.
Maureen's the only woman I ever did trust. She's fat, that's why. A big heifer. But she's the only good-hearted woman I ever knew. As for the rest of them, a lot of filthy, black-souled sluts with pus-filled sores and... I can't breathe.
You want to be all right? Just need something to eat, that's all. Honest!
No, I'm leaving you now. That's for certain. And I don't want to leave worrying about you. Oh, you're such a babe in the woods. A child. I sheltered you too much, I guess. But I just know some money-stealing bitch is going to come along and try to take advantage of you. Remember what I've always told you. The wages of sin is gonorrhea, syphilis, and death. They'll use their bodies to steal from you. They'll steal your life and your soul. Leave them alone. Most of them are filled with diseases that tick. But God will wash them away, like he did in the time of Noah. God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And then God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. And you know what God did then, Ez?
Yes. Flood.
Yes, sir. The flood. Oh, I wish I could be here to see it.
I'll give Deranged 3 out of 5. It's a very enjoyable movie, but there's no really mind-blowing scenes. It's pretty much just a standard old horror flick. It's a B-movie, really. I do like a lot of little scenes, but it's not a very original movie, and overall, I don't think it's as good as Silence of the Lambs, etc. Next movie, Deliverance. Deliverance is a movie about a canoe trip in the American South gone wrong. Listen to the trailer for Deliverance.
Where are you going, city boy?
We'll find it.
It ain't nothing but the biggest river in the state.
These are the men. Nothing very unusual about them. Suburban guys like you or your neighbor. Nothing very unusual about them until they decided to spend one weekend canoeing down the Cahuillawasee River. Ed Gentry, he runs an art service. Wife Martha has a boy, Dee. Louis Medlock has real estate interests, talks about resettling in New Zealand or Uruguay. Drew Ballinger, he's sales supervisor for a soft drink company. Bobby Tripp, bachelor, insurance and mutual funds.
Where you going?
All right, I'm looking.
These are the men who decided not to play golf that weekend. Instead, they sought the river.
There anywhere watching us right now. We ain't gonna be so nice not behind to follow dragging a corpse.
Lewis, I'm gonna pull up to the side. There's something wrong.
No,
go on.
John Boorman's film of James Dickey's explosive best-selling novel.
Deliverance is well known for two scenes in particular, the banjo duel and Squeal Like a Pig. I'll play parts from those scenes very soon after playing what Wikipedia has to say about the movie.
Deliverance is a 1972 drama film produced and directed by John Boorman. Principal cast members include John Voight, Burt Reynolds, Ronnie Cox, and Ned Beatty in his film debut. The film is based on a 1970 novel of the same name by American author James Dickey, who has a small role in the film as a sheriff. The screenplay was written by Dickey and an uncredited Boorman. In 2008, Deliverance was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Four Atlanta businessmen, Lewis, Reynolds, Ed, Voight, Bobby, Beatty, and True, Cox, decide to canoe down the fictional Cahuillawasee River in the remote Georgia wilderness, expecting to have fun and see the glory of nature before the river valley is flooded over by the upcoming construction of a dam and lake. Lewis, an experienced outdoors man, is the de facto leader. Ed is also a veteran of several trips but lacks Lewis' machismo. Bobby and True are novices. From the start, it is clear the four are far from what they know as civilization. The locals are crude and unimpressed with the presence of outsiders, and the film implies some of them are inbred. Drew briefly connects with a local banjo-playing boy by joining him in an impromptu bluegrass jam. But when the song ends, the boy turns away without saying anything, refusing Drew's handshake. The four, city boys, as they are called by one of the locals, exhibit a slightly condescending attitude towards the locals. Bobby in particular is patronizing. Traveling in pairs on the river, the foursome's two canoes are briefly separated. Pausing briefly to get their bearings, Bobby and Ed encounter a pair of unkempt hillbillies, Bill McKinney and Herbert, Cowboy Coward, emerging from the woods, one wielding a loaded shotgun. After a stray comment about a moonshine still offends the hillbillies, Bobby is forced at gunpoint to strip naked. McKinney's character chases after and physically harasses Bobby as he tries to escape. His ear is twisted to bring him to his hands and knees, and he is then ordered to squeal like a pig as McKinney's character proceeds to rape him. Ed is bound to a tree with his own belt, helpless as McKinney's character violently sodomizes Bobby. Hearing the commotion, Lewis, who is wary of danger in the woods, secretly sneaks up and kills the rapist with an arrow from his recurve hunting bow. Meanwhile, the other captor quickly escapes into the woods. A brief but hot-headed debate ensues between Lewis and Drew about whether to inform the authorities. Lewis argues that they would not receive a fair trial, as he claims that the entire local population was related to one another, and the jury would comprise the dead man's friends and relatives. Likewise, Bobby does not want the incident of his sodomy to become public. Lewis tells them that since the entire area would be flooded by a lake soon, the body would never be found, and the escaped hillbilly could not inform the authorities since he had participated in the incident. The men vote to side with Lewis's recommendation to bury the dead hillbilly's body and continue on as though nothing had happened. During the digging, Drew is obviously agitated and screams at each exertion. The four make a run for it downriver, cutting their trip short, but soon disaster strikes as the canoes reach a dangerous stretch of rapids. After repeated requests by Ed to don his life jacket, an unnerved Drew ignores them without a word of explanation. As Drew and Ed reach the rapids in the lead canoe, Drew shakes his head and falls forward into the river. The reason for Drew's fall is left unclear. Drew was either shot and killed by the surviving hillbilly, suffered a stroke of some type from the stress of the incident, or intentionally dove into the heavy rapids, unable to cope personally with his role in covering up the homicide. After Drew disappears into the river, both canoes collide on the rocks, spilling Lewis, Bobby, and Ed into the river. Lewis breaks his femur, and the others are washed ashore alongside him. Encouraged by the badly injured Lewis, who believes they are being stalked by the toothless hillbilly, and knowing that they can never survive the rapids at night, Ed climbs a nearby rock face in order to dispatch the suspected shooter using his bow, while Bobby stays behind to look after Lewis. Ed reaches the top and hides out until the next morning, when the shooter appears on the top of the cliff with a rifle, looking down into the gorge where Lewis and Bobby are located. Ed, a champion archer who earlier was psychologically unable to shoot a deer he was tracking, starts to freeze again in spite of his clear shot. As the man notices Ed and raises his rifle to fire, Ed clumsily releases his arrow as the man's bullet slams into the rock just next to him. He falls down in panic and accidentally stabs himself with one of his own spare arrows. The hillbilly, at first seemingly unaffected and still a threat, now staggers toward him and collapses on top of him with Ed's arrow through his throat. Ed checks the body and sees he is dead, but then suddenly realizes that the man has a full set of teeth and seems to be the wrong man. He then finds false removable teeth inside of the hillbilly's mouth. Ed then lowers the body down the cliff with a rope and climbs down after it. Halfway down, the rope breaks, Ed falls into the river and almost drowns by being tangled up with the corpse. Ed and Bobby weigh down the dead hillbilly with stones and drop him into the river. Later they come upon Drew's corpse, which they also weigh down and sink in the river to ensure that it will never be found. When they finally reach their destination, the town of Aintree, which will soon be submerged by the dammed river, and is being evacuated, they take the injured Lewis to the hospital while the sheriff comes to investigate the incident. True to Lewis's predictions, one of the deputies is related to the deceased hillbillies, and is highly suspicious. The three carefully concoct a cover story for the authorities about Drew's death and disappearance being an accident, lying about their ordeal to Sheriff Bullard, played by author James Dickey, in order to escape a possible double murder charge. The sheriff clearly doesn't believe them, but seems to have figured out what actually happened. After thinking it over, he simply tells the men, "I don't ever wanna see you around here again. I'd kinda like to see this town die peaceful." The three readily agree. The three vow to keep their story a secret for the rest of their lives, which proves to be psychologically burdensome for Ed. In the final scene, Ed awakes screaming from a nightmare in which a dead man's hand rises from the lake.
Pretty brutal. Okay, first I'll play the banjo jewel. One of the main characters plays his guitar against a local boy, who doesn't seem quite right. The movie crew looked for someone who looked, well, retarded. Billy Redden, the boy who plays the character, is mentally fine, but he doesn't look very normal in the movie. The banjo kid's character's called Lonnie. Well, so Lonnie plays his banjo against a guitar and wins. See if you recognize the song. It's a pop culture moment. It's been parodied in The Simpsons, Family Guy, and other places. Here's the clip.
I don't think you understood me. I want to get some drivers to drive this car and that car down to Aintree. Drivers, you understand?
You might get a driver, brother.
Who?
A driver, brother.
Where do they live?
They live back home that way.
Isn't that pitiful?
Who's picking a banjo here?
I believe you could.
That's good.
That's very good, sir.
God damn, you play a mean banjo.
Hey, you want to play another one?
Give him a couple of bucks.
At the end, Lonnie, the not-right-looking boy with the banjo, turns his head away awkwardly from the main characters. He shows up in a weird way in the later parts of the movie, on a creepy suspension bridge, watching the canoe go down the river. Something interesting. Billy Redden, the guy playing Lonnie, the banjo kid, is not actually playing the banjo. He's wearing a weird shirt, with a very good banjo player reaching through from behind Billy. His hands seem to belong to Lonnie. The other popular scene from Deliverance is Squeal Like a Pig. Two of the three main characters come across locals. One main character gets tied up, and the other, well, he gets raped by a scary southern guy. He gets told to squeal like a pig. Also, he's got a real pretty mouth. At the end of the scene, the third main character saves the other two by shooting one of them with his bow.
Take him off.
Come on, Biggie, give me a ride.
Hey, boy, get up and give me a ride.
All right.
Get up and give me a ride, boy.
All right.
Get up.
All right.
Get up there.
No.
Come on. Look like we got us a sow here instead of a boy.
Don't.
Yeah, boy. I bet you squeal. I bet you squeal like a pig.
Squeal.
Squeal now. Squeal. Squeal. Squeal louder. 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 Louder, get down there, boy. Okay. Hey, them bridges down. Yes, sir. You do better than that, boy. You do better than that. Come on, squeal. Squeal.
Thank you. to do with it?
He got a little pretty mouth, ain't he?
That's the truth.
You're going to do some praying for me, boy. And you better pray good.
I'd give Deliverance 3 out of 5 again. It's not an amazingly good movie as a whole, but it does deserve its place in popular culture. 3 out of 5 on the Jordanometer for both movies so far. Doesn't sound like they deserve a special podcast episode with 3 out of 5, but they are interesting movies in their own way. Just not that amazing to watch if you ask me. I mean, they have great scenes, classic scenes that you need to see, but the whole movie, as a whole, is not very good compared to awesome movies like Forrest Gump. My last movie, Soylent Green. This is a fun movie for vegans to watch. It's basically about how screwed up the world's going to become, from overpopulation to corporations. In the future, meat and regular decent food are almost impossible to find. People eating Soylent products. Soylent Red, Soylent Yellow, and the latest version, Soylent Green. Thanks to Wikipedia, a jar of strawberry jam is said to cost $150, which isn't really that much when you think about inflation, etc. The movie's set in 2022, which sounds far out, but it's 2009 now, remember? When the movie came out, in 1973, $150 a jar of jam would have sounded expensive. But really, $150 is not that much money anymore. It is for jam, but not overall a huge sum of money. The way the recession's hitting America, hyperinflation could come about very easily. Some third world countries have ultra-high value notes now. You pay for things with $100,000 notes. I think Zimbabwe is up to a $1 billion note now. So paying $150 for jam doesn't sound very expensive, if we have hyperinflation, by our standards, in the year 2022. I guess in the 70s, a jar of jam would have cost 5.2 cents American money, so $150 sounds a lot of money. In the movie, they make it seem like only millionaires have food like we eat today. Everyone else has to make do on these government handout Soylent products. People act like they've never even heard of jam, and they can't read at all. I don't think it would be that hard for a group of people to save up money for jam. It's essential, you know. It's a fun thing to think about. I mean, the movie made in the 70s, 2022 must have been like a billion years away. Well, it's just around the corner now, and it seems unlikely that in a few short years we won't be able to read or afford jam. I guess we predict stupid stuff too, though. The future never gets accurately predicted by anyone. Here's the trailer for Soylent Green.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
New York City, in the year 2022. Nothing runs anymore. Nothing works. But the people are the same. And the people will do anything to get what they need.
This is the police!
What they need most is Soylent Green.
The supply of Soylent Green has been exhausted. Return to your home!
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
Detective Sergeant Thorne. He has a 2-year backlog of unsolved murders. Now he's on a case that must be solved. Saul Roth, Thorne's private library.
Hey, Saul!
A living book in a world without books.
Have some pencils, courtesy of your next assignment. William R. Simonson.
Simonson. He was the first to learn the secret of Soylent Green.
They told me to
to say that they were sorry, but that you had become unreliable.
Saul Roth was the next to know.
How did we come to this?
And he chose to die rather than reveal the secret of Soylent Green.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
Why did you set up Simonson?
I didn't.
Cheryl.
I see your hands.
Officially, she's furniture. She comes with the apartment. She belongs to the tenant.
How many times you been in trouble with the police, Cheryl?
Never.
Can't hear you.
Never.
Captain Hatcher. First, he wanted this case solved.
Simonson. What do you say?
It was an assassination.
Now, he just wants it closed.
Who bought you? High and hot, and they want this case closed permanently. Their way. Now, you sign this.
You sign it!
Thorne refuses to close the Simonson case.
Just do what you have to do. Where did you go with Simonson?
He took me to church.
Church?
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 6 months since my last confession.
Carlton Heston, Edward G. Robinson, Chuck Connors, Lee Taylor Young, Brock Peters, Paula Kelly, and Joseph Cotton fight for survival and try to solve the most bizarre riddle ever to face mankind. The search for the secret of Soylent Green. You will find out why Soylent Green means life. You will find out why Soylent Green means death.
We've got to stop him!
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
Please!
Funky noises, huh? The future is all about eerie sounds, remember? Thunderbirds had those same kind of whip-whoop-whoop-whoop-whoop-whoop noises too. I like the way Soylent Green sounds. I might start calling soy products Soylent something from now on, so my soy milk will become Soylent White, being white. Here's the plot for Soylent Green.
Soylent Green is a 1973 dystopian science fiction movie depicting a future in which global warming and overpopulation lead to depleted resources on Earth. This in turn leads to widespread unemployment and poverty. Real fruit, vegetables, and meat are rare, commodities are expensive, and much of the population survives on processed food rations, including Soylent Green wafers. The film overlays the science fiction and police procedural genres as it depicts the efforts of New York City Police Detective Robert Thorne, Charlton Heston, and elderly police researcher Sol Roth, Edward G. Robinson, to investigate the brutal murder of a wealthy businessman named William R. Simonson, Joseph Cotton. Thorne and Roth uncover clues which suggest that it is more than simply a bungled burglary. Set in the year 2022, Soylent Green depicts a dystopian future in which the population has grown to 40 million in New York City alone. Most housing is dilapidated and overcrowded, and the impoverished homeless fill the streets and line the fire escapes and stairways of buildings. Food as we know it today, including fruit, vegetables, and meat, is a rare and expensive commodity. Half of the world's population survives on processed rations produced by the massive Soylent Corporation, from soy, bean, lent, ill, including Soylent Red and Soylent Yellow, which are advertised as high-energy vegetable concentrates. The newest product is Soylent Green, a small green wafer which is advertised as being produced from high-energy plankton. It is much more nutritious and palatable than the red and yellow varieties, but it is, like most other food, in short supply, which often leads to riots. Processed Soylent Green ration wafers. Robert Thorne, Charlton Heston, is a New York City police detective who lives in a dilapidated, cramped one-room apartment with his aged partner Sol Roth, Edward G. Robinson. Roth is a former professor who searches through the now disordered remnants of written records and books to help Thorne's investigations. Roth and his like are known as books. He tells Thorne about the times before the ecological disaster and population crisis, when real food was plentiful, although Thorne is generally not interested in the stories. Thorne is assigned to investigate the murder of William R. Simonson, Joseph Cotton. When he goes to the crime scene, he finds Simonson lying in a pool of blood from being struck multiple times in the back of the head. Instead of looking for clues, the poorly paid detective helps himself to some of the wealthy man's food, liquor, soap, and books. He also questions Cheryl Lee Taylor Young, an attractive 24-year-old prostitute, euphemistically known as Furniture, who comes with the luxury apartment, and Simonson's bodyguard, Tab Fielding, Chuck Connors, who claims that he was told to escort Cheryl on a shopping trip when the attack took place. Returning to his apartment, he gives Sol two large books he took from Simonson's apartment, the two-volume Soylent Oceanographic Survey Report, 2015-2019. Thorne returns to work and talks to the chief of detectives, telling him that he suspects it may have been an assassination, since nothing was stolen from the apartment and the murder seemed professional. He finds it odd that the luxury apartment's sophisticated alarm and monitoring electronics happened to be inoperative on the night of the murder, and his bodyguard just happened to be out of the apartment at the time. After Thorne questions Fielding's live-in furniture, he realizes she was eating from a $150 a jar container of strawberry jam, which is an out-of-place luxury for the prostitute of a bodyguard. He returns to his own apartment to eat a meal of the purloined food, where Sol tells him that Simonson was a member of the board of directors of the Soylent Corporation, one of the most powerful corporations in the world. Thorne then returns to question Cheryl, who tells him that Simonson had become deeply troubled in the days before his death, even taking her to church. Thorne later attempts to question the priest about Simonson's confession, but the priest is almost catatonic with exhaustion and does not reveal anything. Fielding later murders the priest to ensure he never talks. After Thorne begins to uncover evidence on why Simonson was murdered, New York Governor Santini, Whit Bissell, instructs Thorne's superior officer, Lieutenant Hatcher, Brock Peters, to close the investigation. However, Thorne refuses and continues his investigation into the murder. Later, when Thorne is on riot duty during the distribution of rations, Simonson's murderer fires several shots at Thorne, wounding him, but Thorne is able to push his attacker under a riot control vehicle, a scoop. In the meantime, Roth goes over oceanographic reports that Thorne took from Simonson's apartment with other intellectuals at the Supreme Exchange, a library of old books. The other books convince Roth of a horrible truth, which despite reading it for himself he finds almost impossible to believe. The books intend to use the overwhelming evidence against the Soylent Corporation and to prove what Soylent is doing before taking it to the Council of Nations. Unable to live with what he has uncovered, Roth opts for assisted suicide or active, voluntary euthanasia, euphemistically known as going home at a government clinic. There, he is taken to a comfortable bed, is given a poison-laced beverage, and is shown panoramic views of an unspoiled pristine earth as he dies. As Roth is viewing this, Thorne, who has since read a note from Roth that he is going home, forces the staff to allow him to see and talk to Roth. He thus sees the earth as it once was for the first time. Overwhelmed at seeing what is for him such wondrous natural beauty, he is moved to tears. During Roth's final moments, he begs Thorne to prove that horrible truth about Simonson, Soylent. After Roth dies, Thorne sneaks into the basement of the government-assisted suicide facility, where he sees corpses being loaded onto waste disposal trucks. He secretly hitches a ride on one of the trucks, which is driven to a heavily guarded waste disposal plant. Once inside the plant, Thorne sees how the corpses are processed into Soylent green wafers. After Thorne escapes from the plant and heads for the Supreme Exchange with the information, he is ambushed by Fielding and several other gunmen. In the shootout, Thorne kills some of the gunmen, but is himself wounded and retreats into a cathedral filled with homeless people. After a desperate fight, Thorne stabs and kills Fielding. When police backup arrives, The seriously wounded and nearly hysterical Thorne confides to Hatcher the horrible secret behind Soylent Green and urges him to spread the word. Soylent Green is people. We've got to stop them somehow.
Soylent Green, the food product, has been in modern TV series. In Futurama, it's a common food. Even though people know it's made from actual people, it's just accepted. In The Simpsons, it showed up too. An interesting fact, the guy who plays the old guy in the movie, Edward G. Robinson, he died 12 days after filming was finished. It was the 101st movie that he'd been in. Here's a part from the end of the movie, when the main character finds out what Soylent Green really is.
It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them Soylent Green is people!
To shake things up a bit, I'm going to give Soylent Green 4 out of 5 because of its interesting message about the future, you know, a few years from now. Some scenes are pretty stupid. Like at the food riots, people are broken up by riot police. One of the tools they use are these big dump trucks that scoop people up and into the back of them. Well, I think future police won't have special people-picker-upper truck things. They'll use pepper spray or tasers, just like now. Not just some big trucks rigged up with bulldozer bits on the front. A zany movie prop. All old movies look dated, but these three 1970s horror movies have great scenes, and that makes them worth watching. I hope you do decide to rent, or even buy these great, fantastic, amazing, world-changing movies that I rated as 3s and a 4 out of 5. Thank you for listening to this episode of Jay Won't Dart's podcast. If you want to contact me, even just to say you listened, send an email to jaywontdart@gmail.com. jaywontdart@gmail.com. I'd appreciate it. Have a super happy day. Bye.
These people out there, and anyone who's worked with the public in a government agency, they run into them because they're always calling in and complaining about this sort of thing. You know, you go over there and the guy's got aluminum foil plastered all over the walls and a thing on his head, and he's always pointing here and pointing there saying, yeah, they got a beam coming in from the window and they're trying to bake me over here and on one thing or another.
Right, but see, I don't write those guys off. I really don't.
Yeah, well, you should. Well, maybe you do hang out with them. I'm not sure, but
I find them to be
hard to deal with. To be honest about it, for one thing, they're so sincere, and they're looking for someone to believe them. That it's like it's kind of, I don't know. I feel uncomfortable around those folks. Sorry for you out there. I'm sure there's a few of them listening to this show.
I would hope so, because they're the only true connection to what's going on. Send all your crazy shit to me. I won't call you a nutcase.